Deonandian Podcast. I'm Dr. Rewat Deonandan, Global Health Epidemiologist, and today's episode is a live presentation by my teaching assistant, a PhD student at the University of Ottawa, who's doing her thesis on sexual network analysis. And unfortunately, the audio quality is very poor because I was recording this from the back of the classroom on a cell phone. I did not think this through well. I'm sorry. But we get what we get, and you can hear most of it fairly well. And hopefully in the future I can get Kahina to come back and do a more detailed presentation with better quality audio. Until then, please enjoy her presentation.
Or who do you sleep with, or who do you share needles with, it's not enough. Sometimes location is really actually important. People don't remember names, too. So they may just say, hey, John, or I shared it with John, but John would identify himself as George. But really, the location, maybe they meet at the specific bar. So there's a lot of insightful information that could be taken from sexual network analysis. So one of the huge issues with analyzing hidden populations is that there's no sampling frame, right? Because due to the sensitive nature of the behaviors in the population, there's no registry of injection drug users in Ottawa, or sex workers, or street youth, or homeless. So it's very difficult to use the standard of sampling and estimation techniques. So the idea of RDS came up in 1997, and it's been pretty useful in getting a large enough sample size of individuals in that population. So how the process works is seeds are selected. When we say seeds, they're individuals that are known to be in that population, that are known to have a lot of, a bigger network size. When I say network size, they know a lot of people. So the researchers or nurses or whoever would be more suited to interact with these individuals would find them, and they would give them a set of number of uniquely coded referral coupons, so that they would recruit it to their friends. And then, so it's pretty much then those people that come in, the respondents that come in, are also, we would give them, like they'd answer the survey questions, they take blood tests, urine tests, and they would also get coupons, and they would distribute it among their other respondents. So it's like the recruitment is processed by the participants. There's three central information in order for us to visualize the interaction among these people, among hidden populations. And as we need to know, we need to know the personal network size, which is also referred to as degree. We need to know the respondent serial number and respondent's recruited serial number, because they're specific, those coupons have specific codes. So we know who recruited who, and like see if we could see how many people actually are key members by these recruitments. So, like any kind of sampling methodology, you have two components. One called data collection, and then the inference component. So data collection over the years has proven to be very successful, but in the inference section, it's quite problematic. So basically, in traditional method, you have your population. We use some either random sampling method, stratified sampling method, clustering, and then you would get a sample, and then from that, we would estimate parameters of the population. In RDS, you collect it through this whole mechanism where there's not random, there's no independent, the data is not independent from it, it's very dependent. And we collect that sample. What we use with that sample is we estimate the social network. And from the social network, we make estimates about the population. So it sounds ideal, but there are a lot of strong assumptions associated with respondent-driven sampling. First, the seeds are drawn with probability proportional to their degree. So degree, again, just it's your network size. Individuals in the target population maintain a reciprocal relationship with their context. That is, if I nominate John George, then George, when they ask the same question, George would mention me and John would mention me. Each individual can be reached by another individual through a series of network ties. That means that the network, in the end, even if we have, for instance, if we were looking at injection drug users, and we noticed that it would segregate between males and females. Females would like to stay with females, males would like to stay with males. What we notice is that eventually there's going to be one person, which we call bridgers, that would be able to kind of tie the whole network in. Sampling is with replacement, which is not the case in respondent-driven sampling. So sampling is with replacement means that individuals can be resampled, individuals can be included several times in our survey, but that's not the case. Individuals' network size is accurate, which we all know that it's kind of a little bit difficult. When we're talking about this, we're not talking about the general population where I would say, I'd ask an individual and say, hi, how many people do you end up sleeping with in a year or something like that? Most people can remember that, but we're looking at more specific hard-to-reach populations, including some sex workers or injection drug users. So it's not really, they have multiple partners. It's not something that you can easily measure accurately. And then random referrals. So even though the question is specific in who do you interact with, who do you share needles, when we say that, they are supposed to distribute their coupons randomly among their circle of network. So over the years, it's been a huge thing to develop these estimators that are associated with less stringent assumptions. So there's the naive estimator that was first introduced in 1997 by Hackathorne, who also is the one who brought up the whole concept of RDS. And it's based on Markov chain theory and the theory of biased networks. They pretty much use kind of traditional statistical analysis where they say the sample of your proportion that we obtained from RDS is a great representative of the population portion. Problem with this is that it ignores the whole sample design. And then Salganik and Hackathorne introduced a new estimator. It does not take into consideration differential recruitment. When I say differential recruitment, it means that when we use the word homophily, it means that I'm most likely going to recruit people that have similar characteristics as me. For instance, when I said about the injection drug users, like females recruiting other females. That's an example. Differential recruitment means that a female recruiting, for instance, if we're looking at the character of sex, they recruit male. And it does not analyze continuous variables. So Hackathorne introduced a new estimator, and it had very strong assumptions about the already human response to these survey questions. And the variance, we always need variance because we want to calculate usually the confidence interval, was underdeveloped. So it wasn't very useful to just get an estimate without some sort of idea of how reliable that estimate is. Volz and Hackathorne came up with one that had very strong assumptions associated with respondent behavior. And actually, even though that's the case, they are the current most popular estimator used out there right now when analyzing RDS data. And then we have two new ones, successive sampling and network-assisted modeling RDS. So the theories that derive these estimators are they're kind of complex. And they're trying to explain how they can get away with certain of these assumptions by saying that some of them follow, the recruitment process follows this particular mathematical model. So our objective is to apply and compare the current RDS estimators to the following data collected through RDS in real hard-to-reach populations from a cross-sectional study conducted in Ottawa and Winnipeg. And they would include injection drug users, street youth, men who have sex with men, women who have sex with women. And our overall goal is to identify a gold standard estimator for the population parameter of interest based on realistic assumptions about the RDS process. It's important to note that when we said men who have sex with men or women who have sex with women, they're not from the general population. They're usually either sex workers, injection drug users, homeless. They're in that within that circle. So we have a sample size in Winnipeg of 600, and it consists of 150 individuals from the different categories that I listed. And in Ottawa, 225. I know it doesn't add up to 75, but some of them do overlap. Our plan of action is that so performance of RDS could generally fall into three categories. Analytical results, meaning analytical proof, simulation studies, and then the last one, studies using data from hidden populations. One and two have already been provided using previous estimators and will be reconducted using an appropriate simulation study. And three is the analysis of the real RDS data, which will be conducted via RDStat and R software. So the simulation studies would be conducted via, actually, in this case I said StatNet, but most likely R. And what we're planning to do is, like, we simulate 500 to 1,000 networks with a specified structure. We implement a variant of the RDS sampling process with desired characteristics on each network. And the first two actually are going to be, we're going to obtain kind of that information on my second objective. And then we're going to compute the mentioned estimators of the population proportions and repeat 1 to 3 with variants of the network structure and sampling process. The limitation. So analytical results in simulation studies provide us with precision and properties of the estimator under specific conditions, which may be irrelevant to what actually happens in RDS studies, since they depend on assumptions that bear little relationship to to reality. And then studies involving hard-to-reach populations are relevant, but validity is extremely difficult as the underlying truth is unknown. Topology of sexual networks. So when I say topology, I'm referring to network structure. Usually, compartmentalized models have been very useful in infectious disease to try to understand the spread of infectious disease. You guys pretty much know CIS model, I'm assuming, susceptible, infected, and back to susceptible, or susceptible, infected, and then, was it Arden? Sir, what was it? Reen? No.
We didn't cover it in this class, so maybe.
Sorry?
We didn't cover that in this class.
Oh, you didn't cover that in that class?
No.
Okay. Oh, sorry, then I guess I can't. Better slide on this. Okay, well, pretty much, it's like, I guess you have, like, your susceptible population, and then it transfers into infected, and R, I just realized it was recovered. With some of these susceptible, infected, and resusceptible, or immunity. And some of them are also, it depends. There's a lot of different models with compartmentalized. It depends what kind of infectious disease you're looking at. So, for instance, HIV, there's no recovery, right? So, anyway, these models are really useful. They've been really great at explaining, trying to identify how many cases we can expect. So when R0, which is the reproductive rate, and it measures the number of secondary infection produced by a single infected host, when R0 is greater than 1, there's a high probability that there will be an epidemic. When it's less than 1, there's a high probability that the disease will go extinct. But there are very, very strong assumptions with these compartmental models. For instance, interaction between individuals is at random. There's a constant population size and well-mixed population, as each person is believed to have the same number of contacts, and each susceptible individual has the same probability of getting infected when in contact with an infected individual. And you're usually dealing with a large population. And I guess in this case, model implications are difficult to interpret because sometimes trying to adjust or take into human interaction in these models, it becomes a little bit you're unable to really make proper inference about these the results that you get. And for instance, SARS, when SARS came out and they used compartmentalized modeling, they estimated like pretty much a ridiculous number of cases. Or really, they only got maybe a few thousand. They estimated a few thousand cases, but really they only got a few hundred. So when it comes to studying sexual transmitted infections and bloodborne pathogens, random interaction among the population is just not a realistic assumption. They're influenced by human behavior, which forms a type of network. And networks can be classified according to the distribution of connections. One in particular type of network that is believed to describe the dynamics of sexual transmitted infections is called small world. And small world links are created through a combination of randomness and roles. They usually produce an extremely skewed distribution, and it's usually described by a power law. So there are three different types of small world structure. There's a scale-free, broad scale, and single scale. Scale-free is the major type of distribution that's linked with infectious disease. So here you'll see an example of a random network, which was introduced by Erdos and Rini. We call it the ER model, and the scale-free. Now, scale-free, I'm using Barbacci-Albert, but there's Watts and Strogatz that have another interpretation of how to explain what's going on, the mechanism of why we see some sort of organization within the networks, or development of hubs. When we say hubs, it means that there's one individual in particular in that population that is really connected with several people. So as you can see in the random network to the right, there's not really a pattern. But when you reorganize it into a scale-free, you see that it's organized into structures and that there are about five key nodes, the red ones, that are pretty much are connected to, they can be connected to 60% of the other nodes in some way, some form. So pretty much if we wanted to implement an intervention at this point, it would be those five nodes would be our key players right there. So our objective is to determine whether the structure of the networks formed among the four different high-risk groups with respect to sexual transmitted infections and bloodborne diseases are considered to have a small world structure. And then we would possibly recommend potential new interventions to reduce the transmission of STIs among these high-risk groups. Our plan of action is to determine whether any of these networks form a scale-free-like structure, and then to determine the network exhibit a preferential attachment mechanism. We want to find out if they actually have a critical threshold within these networks, and maximum likelihood estimation, yield model, and nonlinear regression methods will be used to fit curves to estimate the distribution and tail end. So overall, really what we want to do is we want to evaluate these estimators to see if actually any of them can be really reliable when we want to make inference on that type of population for public health purposes, of course. So we have our hidden population, we have our sample, our social network. What we plan to do is kind of form we want to kind of have a gradient from theoretical to reality, right? To really see theory, it's great. Everything works out in theory. But we want that kind of link to reality to kind of evaluate these estimators, see which one does best, which one represents that kind of what happens really in practice. So our goal is to kind of study the network topology, possibly use other types of non-random sampling methodologies like capture-recapture, venue kind of sampling, convenient sampling, in order for us to understand a little bit more characteristics about that hidden population. I didn't mention this previously because it was getting into theories, into more complex mathematical theories, some of these assumptions are associated with knowing the population size. And like I said beforehand, we actually have no idea what the population size are. There's a new method, one of these huge guys, one of you, like the well-known RDS experts that had developed a kind of Bayesian mathematical modeling to estimate a population size. It seems kind of promising. Everything seems kind of promising these days. But what we hope to do is kind of get as much as characteristics available so that we can estimate an appropriate social network in our simulation study. And so use that kind of simulated network and also use real data, like I said, to develop kind of an understanding between theory and reality for inferential purposes, of course. So overall goal, we'd like to shed some light in RDS inference. We want to identify structures of the network in vulnerable populations and determine whether there's a critical threshold, suggest improved and efficient interventions for these type of networks, and just further understanding of why certain STIs and other bloodbornes are stable or increasing despite enhanced detection and therapy. So that's also that's another completely different area, but if you guys have noticed, we do know a lot more about infectious diseases, especially on HIV, even gonorrhea and chlamydia. And if you guys may, I don't know, pay attention to some of like the infectious outbreaks, but we've had quite a few syphilis outbreaks, quite a few HIV outbreaks. And we're just wondering, you know, it'd be nice to understand what's going on with the whole process. And I think that's it. I'm done. Do you have any questions? No, random is not. Small world implies that there's a power law distribution. A scale free has a power law distribution.
Okay, random is
just random. Yeah, it's a random model.
It's not based on behavior.
No, it's just saying, like, again, the interaction. Random models kind of go along with compartmentalized models because it just assumes that I can randomly be connected to this person. I can infect this person. I can infect this person. And that we all have the same number of contacts, but that's not the truth.
Okay, so small takes into account.
It takes into account that there is some sort of organized structure, yes. Yes. Transient infections and bloodborne. Mm-hmm. It's not, that's a good question too. So it comes back to also sexual network analysis when we're taking a cross-sectional study, right? So what cross-sectional, you guys have already discussed that, but it's like, you know, a photo of that time slot, right? So yes, you're right. It does change over the years. So even if you do understand that trend would be particular for that particular population, injection drug users in Winnipeg within that time slot. That's when you'd be able to make inference. But even then, we're having trouble with that. And the reason why we're using RDS, if you have a register or if you have a sampling frame for any type of population, RDS would be completely useless. You would use the random, you know, the more traditional sampling methods. But the fact is, with these populations, you cannot obtain it. For instance, you know, we want to call people randomly. You know, they don't have numbers. You want to use people like, I don't know, go door to door. Even that's not time efficient, but let's say you wanted to do that. Some of them just don't have a place. Right? So you can't, these people are not, they're hidden to the rest of the world. Does that make sense? And that's the way, our way of accessing them is by using individuals within that population, right? And one of the benefits about RDS is also like, we don't really have, what's the term I'm looking for? It's not, everything is pretty much ethical at this point, you know? I asked you, like, I give you a coupon. You don't have to give me your real number, your real name. I have a serial number, right? So there's no information about you. Your privacy is kept. It's not invaded with RDS. Yes?
So at the beginning, you were talking about this autonomous study that you did. So are you using that information to compare to the people? Like, are you actually going to be
okay, the data is, that's pretty much the real, I will be analyzing the real data, but for instance, I want to study the prevalence. HIV among that population. It really wouldn't mean anything if it's not reliable, if all the assumptions have been violated.
Right, so that's the data you're analyzing.
Yes, yes.
To make sure that the
yes, and so, and that's the reason it's a little bit more complex, because analyzing the data, I get an estimate, but that estimate, it means nothing if it's not reliable. So pretty much I have to study the reliability of these estimators that are being used, so that we can say at the end of my whole research project that the estimates that I obtain, for instance, the prevalence of infected individuals with HIV, chlamydia, or gonorrhea, are about.
And that's like that data was taken to the RDS.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Any other questions? I just want to make it clear again that RDS is only used when you don't have a sampling frame. If you have anything with a sampling frame, you should use the traditional sampling methods. It would just be useless. Yeah? No questions? Good? Yes? Yeah, a serial number and serial coupons. Yeah, so what happens is actually, that's a really good question because,
without getting too much complicated things, you identify the sequence, right? Okay, and they form wave zero, we call it wave zero. But what happens is usually we give three coupons to the seeds, right? And the general idea of giving three coupons is that just in case we don't have any non-response, it wouldn't stop the recruitment process. So these people give. So you get one, right? That's wave one. And then they have three. And then they have three. And they have three. So it goes on, it's like a tree, like, you know, tree branch of, even though they give one to another individual, we're hoping that it actually, by doing this recruitment chain, we hope to access individuals that we normally never access. Right? But on the survey, they come in for like an hour, 2 hours survey. I forgot to mention that we give a kind of an incentive. There's usually, with the traditional RDS methods, there's usually a legal incentive. So I pay you to come and answer a question. I also pay you when you bring in response. Does that make sense? So one of the questions would be, who do you, I don't know, for instance, have sex with? Who is among your closest network? And so they name names, and sometimes what happens with that, exactly. Any other questions?
Thank you.